Before we begin, just a note that this episode was recorded live at the Fitton Center for Creative Arts in Hamilton, Ohio. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. On November 1st, 1958, a Saturday, a young man named Cecil Maines spent all morning with two of his friends freezing their tails off in a boat on Cowan Lake, about an hour north of Cincinnati. They were duck hunting. They weren't having any luck. Cecil, Albert Walker, and Dean Jackson had launched before sunrise into a cold drizzle that came and went all day. The ducks were scarce, as in they were outnumbered, by the hunters scattered around the 700-acre reservoir in their blinds. By mid-morning, the young men had given up on Cowan Lake and decided to try Stone Lick, a smaller reservoir about half an hour away on the other side of Blanchester. Maybe the ducks were flying there. Well, they weren't. In fact, it was clear before they even put their boats into Stone Lick that this place was deader duck-wise than Cowan had been. So they goofed around in Blanchester for a while, had lunch, and then headed back to Cowan Lake in the early afternoon. And these guys were nothing if not persistent. Then it started to drizzle. By 4 o'clock, Cecil and his friends had had enough. They decided to call it a day. But things just weren't going their way. The boat's motor wouldn't start. They were at least a mile from the boat ramp. That's a long way to paddle. So they drifted to the beach instead. They could see a few guys in a duck blind a bit to the west, but the beach itself was deserted. One car sat alone in the parking lot. They figured it belonged to the guys in the blind. It was misty and chilly as they dragged the boat up onto the sand. The three of them walked toward the road together at first, their guns in tow, the boat left temporarily behind, as they scouted out a way to get the car and trailer down to the beach. Albert hiked a little ahead of Cecil, who wandered off in a different direction toward the parking lot. That's where Cecil spotted a burned-out fire in a clump of cattails. He tried to make sense of what he saw in the ashes. Now remember, this was November 1st, the day after Halloween. Cecil saw a pair of pale legs in the fire pit. His brain landed on this being some sort of dark joke. You know, a store mannequin that somebody had dragged out here as a gag. He hollered to his friends. Albert Walker's reaction was the same as Cecil's. Well, that's just some Halloween prank. But as he got closer, he noticed the legs had toes. And they were blistered. Dummies don't blister. Slowly, it dawned on the three what they had stumbled upon. They saw a necklace, but there wasn't much of a neck. Albert would later tell police, quote, "You knew where the head would be on the body. You could tell it was a head, but if you had to recognize it as a human head, you wouldn't know," end quote. The three young men ran. They found some guys in a duck blind and told them what they had found. One of them had a car and drove to the nearest phone to call the police. Within hours, Cowan Lake State Park was swarming with investigators. The Clinton County Sheriff's Department, the Ohio State Highway Patrol, and soon, detectives from Cincinnati. Because once they started putting the pieces together, once they looked at that necklace and started asking questions about who from the region might be missing, they realized this was going to be Cincinnati's story. This was going to be front page news for months. The burned body at Cowan Lake belonged to a 32-year-old woman named Louise Bergen. Soon, police were faced with several possible suspects. Louise, it turned out, was enmeshed in a love triangle involving her estranged husband and his live-in girlfriend. Oh, and there also was Louise's boss and a mystery man Louise was believed to be dating, who might have also been her boss. So scratch the love triangle part. This was potentially a square or a pentagon. Whatever the case, police immediately knew they had a big case on their hands. What they didn't know at the time was that it would become one of the most controversial in Cincinnati's history. Before police had a name to put with the body they discovered at Cowan Lake, they called for a Hamilton County pathologist, who would later become the longtime coroner, to come to the scene. Dr. Frank Cleveland examined as much as he could before the sun set and then had the intact corpse taken to the morgue, along with, quote, as much of the wet, charred remains as could be scraped up, end quote. That's from a book about the case written by Richard O. Jones, who I understand is here tonight. I met him backstage. Hi, Richard. Now, I don't share that quote to be sensational, but to underscore just how gruesome this case was. Clinton County Sheriff Lloyd Foote said he'd been sheriff for 22 years and he had seen a lot, but never anything like this. The next day, Dr. Cleveland reported some details about the dead woman. She was white and tall, standing about 5'9", and she weighed between 135 and 150 pounds. He estimated she was between 25 and 35 years old, with dark brown hair. While her face was too fire damaged to attempt an artist's rendering, he could tell from two fractures to the skull that she'd been struck in the head. He could see contusions on the left side of her neck, face, and head, as well as on the right side of her head. The woman had been dead at least 24 hours before the discovery, and given the frigid weather, possibly even longer. Police scoured missing persons reports to see if they could find a match. For much of the first day, they hit dead ends. Then, around 7:30 p.m., a man named Bill Sheridan, who worked at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, said the victim's description aligned with a woman who worked at Still Pass Transit, which did a lot of business with P&G. Louise Bergen had been missing since Thursday, so 2 days before the body was discovered. Sheridan provided as much information as he could to police: that Louise drove a two-tone black and yellow 1950 Oldsmobile and had last been seen wearing a red coat when she left work at 5 p.m. October 30th. Detective Robert Dunbar with the Ohio State Highway Patrol followed up with Still Pass Transit the next day, and by mid-morning, he was sure Louise was his victim. Her family identified the necklace found in the fire pit as having belonged to her. Dental records soon confirmed the match. Louise had been born Martha Louise Van Davier on October 2, 1926, in Galveston, Texas. Her parents were Walter and Abby Van Davier. Walter was Belgian-born. He had immigrated to the United States while young and eventually became a stamp collector enthusiast, the kind of guy who judged philatelic exhibitions and served as the president of the Texas Philatelic Association. In short, he was what some people might call a bit of a nerd. Nothing wrong with that. He'd married Abby Harlan of Oklahoma in 1918, and the couple went on to have four children, three girls and one boy. Louise was third born. In the mid-1940s, the family left Texas for Norfolk, Virginia. That's where, in 1947, Louise met William Henry Bergen at a USO dance. Bill, as he was called, had been stationed there during his service in the U.S. Navy. He was from Manasquan, New Jersey, and had joined the Navy in July 1946. They were engaged in June 1948. The Virginian pilot ran an announcement with Louise's photo. She's beaming and radiant with her dark hair and broad smile. The announcement noted that the wedding would take place on July 15th, and it did. The wedding photo shows them standing together, Louise in a knee-length dress holding a bouquet, Bill in a light-colored suit, and they look happy, just a young couple in 1948, excited to be starting their lives together. They made their home in Virginia. Louise worked for the Ledger Star and Virginian Pilot for a bit. After Bill's discharge from the Navy, he started working for the Federal Civil Service at the Navy Yard and Naval Base. In 1949, they had a daughter, Linda Louise Bergen. After Louise's father, Walter, died in 1951, her mother, Abby, lived with Louise and Bill and Linda, off and on, both in Norfolk and later in Cincinnati, where they moved in 1955 for Bill's job with Colonial Stores. And that was a big 20th century American supermarket chain. You might remember it from its distinctive rooster logo. Anyone? No? The family lived in the Swift Inn Village Apartments on Langdon Farm Road, a sprawling apartment complex in Bond Hill. By the way, Donald Trump would go on to manage that complex a few years later. He and his dad would be sued for racial discrimination. But for the Bergen family in the 1950s, everything looked fine from the outside. Just a young family living in a decent apartment helmed by a man with a steady job. But the marriage was falling apart. And when police asked Bill Bergen about his marital troubles after Louise's body was discovered, he was surprisingly frank. He told them that they had started drifting apart while they were still living in Virginia. He went out a lot, and he didn't like going out with Louise. That caused friction. He played in a band off and on. He went bowling, sometimes as often as every single weeknight. She had a kid, remember? Louise would ask to go and Bill would refuse. He admitted to police, quote, "A couple of times I had dates with other individuals. Nothing that ever became serious," end quote. As though not being serious softened the fact that he was cheating. I don't know. In May 1958, Bill and Louise separated. She moved to a different apartment in the same Swift Inn Village complex. Same building cluster, different unit. It was one floor higher and $10 a month cheaper. Louise took it and moved in with Linda. Bill didn't join them. Instead, he moved in with a woman he had met named Edith Klump. The two had met at the Sky Galley restaurant at Lunken Airport in late February or early March 1958. Edith was a waitress there. Bill had been taking flying lessons at the airport and was immediately smitten. Even before moving out of his apartment with Louise, Bill was pursuing Edith, calling her at work, coming over to her place to watch TV. Within days, they were seeing each other almost every night. Bill told Edith he was getting a divorce. He made it sound like the paperwork was already filed. Of course it wasn't. When Edith found out that he was still living with his wife, she was taken aback. But Bill assured her it was only for financial reasons, and besides, Louise's mother was living there too, so she was sort of like a chaperone. When Bill announced he was moving out, Edith took heart that he had been telling the truth all along. And she even met Louise, who seemed to back up all that Bill said. And by all accounts, Edith and Louise's meeting was actually cordial. Louise said she'd been anxious to meet Edith, but the marriage had been so rocky for so long that she didn't blame her for its demise. The first meeting, Edith walked away feeling like, okay, the man I love is breaking cleanly from his wife. But a few weeks later, Louise asked for another meeting. She was having second thoughts. The day before, Bill had said goodbye to their daughter Linda, and that had rattled her. She told Edith she didn't still love Bill, but she worried about what splitting would do to their daughter. Plus, she didn't want to be alone. Edith, who herself had been divorced twice, said, just go find somebody else. Louise said, well, it's not so easy to do. But quietly, she might have been trying. After Louise's death, people told police they thought she had been dating. In fact, her love life had become a subject of speculation even before her body was found. And there was talk of a mystery man. There was talk of her boss at the transit company. Maybe they were the same person. Maybe they weren't. What's clear is this. Louise Bergen was living in an apartment at 1870 Langdon Farm Road. She was working at the Still Pass Transit Company. She was raising a 9-year-old daughter with help from her mother, Abby. She was navigating life as a separated woman in 1958 Cincinnati, which couldn't have been easy. On Thursday, October 30th, she left work at 5 p.m. The next day, her estranged husband reported her missing. The day after that, duck hunters found her body in a burned-out fire pit at Cowan Lake State Park. Someone had tried to burn her body beyond recognition. It hadn't worked. The investigation into Louise Bergen's murder immediately captured headlines across Cincinnati and beyond. And this wasn't just another homicide. This was a gruesome and tantalizingly complicated mystery. The Cincinnati Post ran the story on its front page for days. I mean, the details were horrifying. It was possible Louise hadn't just been beaten, as Dr. Cleveland initially reported. Based on the saturation levels of carbon dioxide in her blood, she might have been alive when the fire started. And there was more. The evidence was scattered across two different locations. 5 miles from where her burned body was discovered, investigators found Louise's glasses, one shoe, and a triangular block of wood, the kind used to chalk wheels on the slope, in a gravel pit. Police believe Louise had been beaten there first and then moved to the park to be burned. The last person known to have seen Louise alive was Still Pass's fleet superintendent, Mel Abrams. He told police he watched her drive away in her car at quitting time. He remembered she was headed on Spring Grove Avenue in the direction of her home. The day after Louise's body was formally identified, her car was discovered in the parking lot of the Swifton Center Outdoor Mall near a jewelry store. The driver's door was unlocked. Speculation gripped the region. "Who met slain woman at parking lot?" blared a headline in the Cincinnati Post on November 7, 1958. In it, they called the mystery the case of the parking lot date. Twice, they really wanted that nickname to stick. Quote, "Police theorize Mrs. Bergen must have had a date with one of her suitors at the parking lot, that she entered his car and was driven away. Police believe somewhere between the Swifton Shopping Center parking lot and the gravel pit, the two quarreled, that her date hit her in the back of the head at the gravel pit and then took her to the Lake Cowan area where he burned her," end quote. Now, among Louise's suspected suitors was Charles H. Haft, her boss at Still Pass and president treasurer of the firm. He had been friendly with Louise. In fact, the Oldsmobile she drove began as a company car. She had asked to borrow it enough times that Haft eventually said, "You know what, I'll sell it to you cheap." Haft, who, it's important to note, was quite married, insisted this was a goodwill gesture meant to help out a struggling mom whose husband was a philandering ne'er-do-well. Now, of course, Bill Bergen topped the suspect list for some detectives. He was the spouse, after all. But he had been the one to report Louise missing, and he also told police that in the weeks before her death, the estranged couple had started talking of a reconciliation, and he seemed broken up about her death. In an odd twist, Mel Abrams, the last man to see Louise alive, also provided Bill a partial alibi. Mel was best friends with Bill and said Bill had swung by the Still Pass garage around 6 p.m., so about an hour after Louise had driven off. The men chatted briefly, and Bill said he had to get back to work. About 7:30 p.m., Bill showed up at Mel's house in Golf Manor. Now remember, Cowan Lake was about an hour north of Cincinnati, each way, so math just didn't work. Detective Chief Henry Sandman told reporters on November 18th that they had no good clues at all. No one had been found who saw Louise with anyone else on Thursday, October 30th, the day she disappeared. But behind the scenes, police were working methodically through their suspect list. By mid-November, they had interviewed 64 people. They began conducting polygraph tests on November 14th. John Kellum, a man Louise was rumored to have dated in the past, went first. He told Cincinnati patrolman William Berry he had been in love with Louise at one time and that she had wanted to marry him. That was more than a year before her death, though, while she was still with Bill, who she told John had been cheating on her for some time. Kellum said their relationship had cooled long ago and he had nothing to do with her murder. Berry determined he was being truthful. Mel Abrams also passed his polygraph. Then it was Bill Bergen's turn. Now here's the thing about polygraphs. They're not automatically admissible in court for a reason. They can be unreliable, not just because some people can keep their cool enough to pass even when they're lying, but also because they can have trouble reading people who are emotionally traumatized. Berry said Bill walked in a wreck. He was too upset to get a good reading. Detectives asked him to come back a few days later to try again, and Bill agreed. The next up for the polygraph was Edith Klump. When her time came, though, she called and said she had a conflict. Berry agreed to reschedule. In the meantime, Detective Stegenhorst, encouraged by Detective Dunbar, whose spidey senses had him fixated on Edith, began some additional prodding. He learned that Bill owned two guns, a rifle and a handgun, both of which Bill said he used for target shooting. They were kept at the house on Bloomingdale Avenue where Bill lived with Edith. Stegenhorst retrieved the guns and sent them to the Kettering Crime Laboratory for examination. One appeared to have blood at the tip, and its size and shape seemed to match one of the injuries on Louise's skull. And it appeared the poor woman had been pistol whipped. Then Stegenhorst checked Edith's alibi. She told police she had been out window shopping for furniture in Fairfax at 5 p.m. October 30th, right around the time Louise disappeared. But employees at the store Edith had named didn't recognize her when police showed them a photograph. In fact, they didn't remember anyone coming in around that time that day. After her supposed window shopping trip, Edith said she had gone to the sewing class she taught weekly. She was an accomplished seamstress who taught at several different schools. That night, she said she had been running late, but her students confirmed she did show up and teach the class. Now, Bill Bergen retook the polygraph November 18th, and while Berry determined he was still nervous enough to skew the readings, he also said it seemed Bill had no guilty knowledge. In the accompanying 45-minute interview, Bill also said some things that piqued detectives' interest about Edith, that she had told him she had been pregnant twice and that he suspected she was lying both times, that he hadn't told her he wanted to reconcile with Louise, but he suspected she knew anyway, that she had grave financial worries and was living hand-to-mouth, usually buying her daughter's dinner with tip money after she worked a shift. The couple, who had started telling others earlier in the year that they'd officially married when they hadn't, were trying to secure a $9,000 loan on the house Edith had bought with her ex-husband Robert. Of that loan, she would have to give $4,000 to her ex. The rest was to pay off her house and cover outstanding debts. Now, Edith again was scheduled to take her polygraph after Bill, and again she called to cancel. She said she wasn't feeling well and didn't have anyone to take care of her children. and one or the other excuse should have been sufficient, police found it suspicious that she had seen fit to use both. Stegenhorst insisted she come. "We'll find someone to come and take care of your kids for you." And that someone turned out to be Edith's mother, Fan. At 1 p.m., Edith settled in for a test. About an hour into it, some investigators peeled off to search her car. They plugged a 12-volt light into her cigarette lighter to better see the upholstery. It illuminated small specks of a dried brownish substance. The biggest clusters were above the driver's seat and along the door panel. It looked like someone had tried to clean the spots. Meanwhile, Edith's polygraph wrapped up around 4 p.m. An hour later, Barry and Stegenhorst told her she had failed. Not only that, but they had had those dried spots tested by the crime lab. Human blood, they said. Edith argued, no, those are just some malted milk spots one of the kids spilled. The detectives pressed, directly accusing her of killing Louise. Edith pointed to her sewing class. No way I could have done that and gotten back to school on time. Plus, I would have been a wreck. I couldn't have just taught sewing after killing a woman. The detectives wouldn't rest. At 8 p.m., Edith begged to see her children. She said she couldn't think of anything else. Police refused. Then she demanded to see Bill, her lover. That they allowed. The two hugged. Bill told Edith to tell the truth. In a shaky voice, she said she couldn't. It was too fantastic. No one would believe her. "Try us," the officer said. So she did. She said she had, in fact, met Louise Bergen on October 30th. She had been lying about the window shopping. That's what she had planned to do before Louise had called and asked to chat. But things went horribly wrong, and Louise somehow managed to shoot herself with her own gun. We'll talk more about Edith Klump's confusing confession here shortly, but first, I want to tell you what she did after she gave her statement to police. She asked again to see her children, and investigators did something unusual. Despite having already officially arrested her on suspicion of murder, they accompanied her to her house, where she was allowed to say goodbye to her two youngest children and her mother. Edith's mother, Fan, was frantic. "Why are you keeping my daughter so long?" And at this point, Edith had been with police for some 9 hours. Edith tried to calm her mother by saying she hadn't been involved in anything, but she still had to answer more questions to clear a few things up. Now, in her statement, Edith said that Louise had been shot, that in fact, she had managed to shoot herself. This was confounding. No one had detected gunshot wounds during the autopsy. Back at the station, detectives contacted Dr. Cleveland and asked if it was possible Louise had been shot and not just beaten. Cleveland returned to the lab and examined X-rays of Louise's skull and spotted two metal particles. He had just earlier that day released the body for burial, and it was on a train en route to Pennsylvania to be picked up by Louise's family. Cleveland managed to make arrangements to intercept the train and have Louise return to Hamilton County. Edith, at this point, had only given an unrecorded oral statement, which police knew wouldn't satisfy a jury. So they had her begin writing out her version of events at 1:10 a.m., more than 12 hours after her polygraph exam began. About 90 minutes later, officers escorted her to Caldwell Circle, where she said the shooting occurred. The Afternoon Post announced, "Gun story upheld by new tests." Dr. Cleveland, in a new examination of Louise's remains, found that she had, in fact, been shot in the throat. That didn't mean, though, that anyone believed Edith's version of events. Certainly not the Post reporters, who outright called her, quote, "the confessed slayer of her lover's estranged wife," end quote. Not prosecutors, who leveled a first-degree murder charge. and not the general public, which was treated to a front page photo of Edith laughing alongside Detective Eugene Moore under the headline, "I'm no monster, Love Slayer says." Innocent until proven guilty. Who needs that, though? Now, that story skillfully broke a basic journalism rule, which is to not lead with quotations. This lead went, quote, "I'm no monster," end quote, says Edith Klump. "I don't want to talk about what happened at Cowan Lake, but what happened before, it was an accident. I'm no monster," end quote. All of Cincinnati thought otherwise, except for her lawyer. William Foss Hopkins was a noted Cincinnati defense attorney who happened to work at the same firm that had handled Edith's most recent divorce. By this point, Hopkins was a 60-year-old legal veteran who had defended hundreds of murder cases, only two of which had ended in death sentences for his client. Now, he had been in headlines aplenty a year prior when he defended a man accused of killing a beautiful young socialite named Audrey Pugh in April 1956. Pugh had been viciously stabbed 23 times in a case the Cincinnati Inquirer called, quote, "the most brutal, baffling murder in recent Cincinnati history," end quote. Robert Lyons, who had worked as a meter reader, had confessed in the killing, but quickly recanted, saying he was coerced by prosecutors who said admitting to the crime was the only way he would be spared the electric chair. Lucky for him, his recantation was bolstered by 9 witnesses who said Lyons was checking meters in their homes when Pugh was killed. And also, Lyons had severe eczema and was able to prove he left dead skin flakes everywhere he went, yet there was none at the crime scene. Pugh's murder has never been solved. For courtroom gadflies, it seemed like a no-brainer that Foss Hopkins would join the Klump case. The only question was, why had it taken so long? By the time Hopkins first saw his client, her confession had been quoted in newspapers nationwide, courtesy of an Associated Press story. By the way, the Cincy papers had dropped the nickname "The Case of the Parking Lot Date" and replaced it with "The Torch Murder," just much catchier. Hopkins later wrote in a memoir called "Murder Is My Business" that the Edith he saw before him didn't look like the Edith his firm had represented a few years earlier in her divorce. And she had been pudgier then and brunette. Now she was slim and stylish and blonde. Divorce had agreed with her, it seemed. It had also changed how she spelled her name. She'd been bland old E-D-I-T-H before, and now she was blonde E-D-Y-T-H-E. Edith told Hopkins that she had asked police to let her see him before her polygraph, meaning well before she gave her damning statement, but they told her she couldn't talk to a lawyer until after she confessed. This was 1958, 8 years before 1966's landmark Miranda v. Arizona case, which ruled that once the defendant asks for a lawyer, a police interrogation has to halt. Edith also told Hopkins that she only confessed after police told her they understood what she had done was manslaughter, implying she wouldn't be charged with murder. Hopkins told reporters that, as he had been with the Pugh case, he was outraged by the methods police used to strong-arm suspects into giving statements. Quote, "I've argued for years that there should be a public defender or other neutral person present during the entire time a suspect is being questioned, and that during the entire time a tape recording should be made of all that is said," end quote. Kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Some arguments never change. Hopkins, in private, of course, finally asked Edith to tell him what had really happened. He warned her not to hold anything back, saying, "The only clients of mine who don't get a fair verdict are those who lie to me." He was fishing for something specific. See, Edith had told police that she and Louise were alone in Edith's car having a perfectly amiable conversation when Louise suddenly pulled a gun on her. Her story had changed that it was Louise's own gun, though. Faced with the forensic testing that showed a mark on Louise's head matched one of Bill's guns, Edith had backtracked and said, actually, she'd had the gun wrapped in a cloth in her glove box. She had no idea how Louise found it when she turned her back for a minute to adjust her seat. But anyway, the women struggled over the gun and suddenly it went off. Edith said Louise slid down in her seat, blood gushing from her mouth. Edith claimed she panicked and must have blacked out because the next thing she realized, she was sitting on the edge of the back seat. She checked for Louise's pulse but felt nothing. She thought of calling Bill and then realized how insane her story sounded. No one would believe that Louise pulled a gun on her, that she'd killed herself in a struggle. No way. So Edith decided she would have to get rid of the body to save herself. This is the part of the story that Hopkins didn't buy. He knew that Edith, who was at most 130 pounds and stood about 5'5", would have struggled mightily with Louise's body, which was on the higher end of that earlier range given by Dr. Cleveland, about 150 pounds. Yet she told police that she, and she alone, had dragged the dead woman from a car, lifted her into the trunk, driven to Cowan Lake, and then dragged her into the fire pit where she doused her with gasoline she just so happened to have bought recently and set her ablaze. Edith said it was clumsy work. She dropped Louise multiple times, causing the contusions Dr. Cleveland had noted in his autopsy. None of this made sense to Hopkins, who was sure Edith had to have had help. He suspected she was covering for her lover, Bill Bergen. But nothing he said could shake her from her story. Her case barreled toward trial. Inside her cell, Edith was allowed a sewing machine and materials to make dresses for herself to wear in court. It was an unusual arrangement that garnered a bit of media attention, until the Inquirer recently donated its archives to be digitized. Images of Edith toiling at her machine filled old folders about the case in its old library on Elm. The trial started in June 1959, just 7 months after Louise's death. In his memoir, Hopkins wrote of feeling shaky as the trial began. He was facing prosecutor C. Watson Hover, a man he had humiliated in the Pew case. They had what author Richard O. Jones called a contentious professional relationship. Hopkins was an old hat at this and certainly knew his way around a murder case, but Edith's story didn't sit right with him, and that made it tough to feel as confident as he normally felt. Still, he fought doggedly on his client's behalf, in front of, it should be noted, a huge audience. People began lining up before dawn in hopes of securing a seat in the Hamilton County Courthouse. Newspapers ran photos of the looky-loos, most of them women. Don't let anyone tell you women being interested in true crime is a new phenomenon, because that's not true. Hopkins later wrote, quote, elderly ladies carried cushions, the better to sit on the hard benches. Everyone was in attendance but a carnival bum selling balloons, end quote. The Inquirer ran one photo of four females, three women and one outright girl, she's what, maybe 12, eating sandwiches they had packed and brought with them during a courtroom recess so they wouldn't lose their seats. The judge was not thrilled with this move, by the way. Still, he tried to accommodate the public's interest by moving the proceedings to the largest room in the courthouse. There, onlookers heard the motive assigned by Assistant Prosecutor Harry Shetmer. He said that October 30th, 1958 was so-called trigger day because Edith was worried about the loan application she and Bill had submitted together. They had claimed they were legally married in the application, and Edith was panicked the bank would track down Louise, who would blow everything. He said Edith awoke that day with murder on her mind. Hopkins opened his defense by saying that if Edith had done things the way the state claimed, she'd be an outright monster. And he argued that clearly wasn't the case. She was president of the youth group at her church. She sang in its choir, and she even volunteered to teach Girl Scouts how to sew. Yeah, she panicked and made the terrible decision to try to burn Louise Bergen's body. A selfish, shocking choice, no question. But she wasn't on trial for burning a body. She was on trial for murder. Edith took the witness stand. After direct examination, a reporter caught up with her.
Mrs. Klump, you were on the witness stand for approximately better than 3.5 hours at any rate. How do you feel after the ordeal?
I feel terrible. I feel sick at my stomach, actually.
Would you say this was probably the most emotionally trying experience you've ever had in your life?
Probably so.
I was wondering, what is your attitude now as far as Bill Bergen is concerned?
I have no comments on Bill.
What would you like to see as far as a verdict from the jury is concerned in this case?
Well, that's it. I'd like to see not guilty.
Not guilty?
Not guilty.
Would you feel that it might be a fair verdict if they returned, say, a manslaughter verdict in this case?
Well, I feel like I'm not guilty.
That's how she felt. The jury felt otherwise. On July 2nd, 1959, they delivered their verdict. Edith Klump was convicted of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to die. It was clear from the moment Edith Klump heard the verdict, and more so the sentence, that she had never considered she might really be convicted. Reporters who watched the trial said she had no visible reaction. But in the weeks later, the public heard she was a little rattled by the jury's decision. Here she is, talking to a TV reporter.
Mrs. Klump, how do you feel in general, your health is, since the trial has been over?
Not so good.
Haven't felt too good?
No, not too good.
Any particular reason, any particular cause of complaint?
I've been extremely nervous, and I passed out one day and hit my head on the concrete floor and got a concussion.
You did? And how long ago was that?
It's been probably, I just have no idea of time. It's probably around 3 weeks ago, and I before, something like that.
And this has been causing you some discomfort since?
Yes, I'm staying in bed pretty much of the time. I have quite a few headaches.
Oh, I was wondering, how do you spend each day since the trial?
Work jigsaw puzzles or read whenever I got something to read. Just lay in bed.
Does the time pass pretty slowly for you?
Yes.
I understand that they took away your sewing machine.
It wasn't just the machine exactly they took away. I'm not allowed to use the scissors now. And so I can't sew without scissors.
Why did they take the scissors away?
Well, it's a precautionary measure. So,
did you think there was going to be some decision in your case today?
Well, I did until right before I went downstairs. I saw in the paper that the judge would probably take a while to decide on it.
You didn't think that you'd be sentenced today?
No, I figured he'd weigh the arguments.
Have your opinions changed at all about the verdict since the trial's been over?
No, I'm innocent of it.
She was initially set to die just 5 months after her trial on December 15th, 1959, which made her next answer a little perplexing to me.
Well, how have your children been?
They've been fine.
Are they in Cincinnati?
Well, the two are in Cincinnati, but they're not home. They're with friends, and the other, my oldest girl is out of town with friends for the for their vacation. They've been to camp and back. They've had quite a nice summer.
Okay, then. Now, truly, Edith was an odd character. She simply didn't seem to grasp the gravity of what she faced. At one point, around the same time her trial wrapped up, reporters discovered that she had been swapping sappy love notes with a North Carolina inmate named George Draper, who was in jail on a charge he had defrauded a hotel keeper. The two would apparently toss the notes back and forth from porches of the men's and women's cell blocks. Judge Ferd Bader read Draper for filth in a dressing down that made the papers. Edith, meanwhile, said her notes were just a joke, inspired by boredom and sent, quote, to a guy so gullible to believe he was irresistible, end quote. Maybe that was important levity for her. After all, in other newspapers, the very same day that tidbit ran, Edith's somber photo ran alongside headlines like Sentenced to Die and Lady Killer. Anyway, to her credit, Edith did seem more concerned about her conviction than she did about George Draper. In August, she asked to speak to a minister, to whom she told a markedly different version of what happened in her car with Louise Bergen on October 30th, 1958. The minister soon relayed that new version to Foss Hopkins, Edith's attorney. It would seem that Hopkins' suspicions about Edith working alone were justified. According to Edith now, she and Louise were not alone in the car that night. Bill Bergen was with them. She had driven Bill to pick up Louise, and the trio drove toward a spot the jury had never heard about, Stratton Drive, a secluded side street in Mount Washington. Bill and Louise were set to iron out some divorce details. Edith excused herself briefly to use the restroom and walked to a new subdivision near where they had parked. Edith was away for about 5 minutes, she said. In a new 5-page statement, she wrote, quote, when I came back, Louise was on the front seat and he was leaning over her. I don't know what he was doing. I got excited and passed out. I went down on the ground. Her head was all bloody. I didn't see anything in his hand. I didn't see the gun. When I came to, Bill was bringing me to. I looked at her again and felt her pulse, and then I started running down the road. I said I was going to go for help. Bill told me to get back there or I would get some of the same thing. He opened the trunk and told me to help him. When I wouldn't, he started yelling. End quote. Edith said that Bill told her the two were arguing and Louise had started to cry. She reached in her purse for a tissue and then leaned over and opened the glove compartment, which just so happened to have a gun in it. Louise grabbed the gun and Bill reached for it and the gun went off beneath Louise's chin. Now, there were a couple of elements of Bill's story that didn't sit well with Edith. For starters, she was certain she had locked her glove box, which would have meant that someone had to unlock it for Louise to find a gun inside of it. And also, Edith said she spotted a bloody monkey wrench on the floor of the car that quickly disappeared and was never again located. In her state of shock, Edith said she didn't think to ask Bill to explain the wrench. In her new statement, Edith said Louise's dead body stayed in the trunk of her car all night. It was there when she rushed to teach her sewing students. It was still there when she got home afterward and put her two young children to bed. As for burning Louise's body, Edith said Bill started that without her, but got spooked it was taking so long. So the next day, he insisted she circle back to finish the cremation. And get this. She was set to babysit 3 kids that day, so she took the children with her. She bought them some toys and bundled them up, and these kids, ages 4, 2, and 18 months, sat for hours in the car while Edith drove to Cowan Lake and did a half-assed job trying to burn Louise. She told police she didn't stay long, though. She found the whole ordeal nauseating and quickly lost her nerve. By the way, the oldest boy she babysat, Jay, was later interviewed. Luckily, all he remembered about this event was going for a long ride with a bunch of toys and that he saw a boat. So, whoosh. Now, this new version of events might sound like bull to you. I don't blame you if that's what you're thinking. After all, Edith didn't say any of this before she was convicted. Her explanation for that? Well, she said Bill had assured her the jury would believe it was an accident. There was no way they would convict a single mother on the evidence they had, much less sentence her to die. Edith said she believed him. she had been genuinely shocked at the conviction, and more than that, at Bill's attitude toward her after it happened. I mean, he dropped her like a bad habit. Her story might seem like a convenient explanation, but there was an awfully good reason police and prosecutors should have at least paid attention to the second confession, and that was the addition of the Stratton Drive location, which turned out to be significant. So remember how investigators had retrieved Louise's necklace from the fire pit at Cowan Lake and Louise's family used it to identify her? Well, they'd seen most of that necklace. Parts of it had broken off, and those broken pieces had been discovered on Stratton Drive. What's more, if police had been looking hard enough, they would have known this long before Edith's second confession, even before her trial. On October 30th, 1958, the day Louise was last seen alive, someone turned in to police a pair of glasses, a portion of a necklace, and a pair of children's bloodied shorts discovered on Stratton. They'd been found by a contractor working security in the area. That contractor thought it was possible those items were a prank, Halloween and all, but he was certain the blood was really blood, so he wasn't about to take any chances. A deputy logged the items and sent them to the Kettering Crime Laboratory, where other items from Louise's case would be sent 2 days later. Upon hearing about Edith's new confession, that deputy, Erwin Schulte, decided to track down the package. He found that it had landed at the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office, but that was just a coincidence. No one had pieced together the items with Louise's death until after Edith's new confession. On December 15th, the day Edith was originally set to be executed, her lawyer instead was arguing her case at the First District Court of Appeals. He lost. But Hopkins wasn't ready to give up. Armed with Edith's new confession, the newly discovered evidence, and Edith's mother and children ready to plead her case, Hopkins met with Ohio Governor Michael DeSalle to talk about clemency. DeSalle, a Democrat, was a strong opponent of capital punishment. He had recently intervened in other high-profile cases. DeSalle agreed to review Edith's case and launched his own investigation, carried out by the Ohio State Patrol. His investigation led him to believe that Edith's second story was much more plausible than her first, largely because that new location addressed one of the lingering questions many had had about her original statement. First, there was the fact that the OG death spot was an hour away from Cincinnati. Bill's alibi was deemed solid because he couldn't have made it there and back in time to see Mel Abrams, yet Edith had the same travel time issue. She was back in time to teach her sewing class just past 7. It would have been nearly impossible. But if the murder had happened on Stratton Drive, the timing question was fixed. Second, Edith still was far smaller than Louise Bergen, yet her first story had her dragging the body to and fro without any help. It made a lot more sense for Bill to have helped. As soon as Hamilton County Prosecutor C. Watson Hubbard learned that DeSalle had questions about the conviction, he basically lost his mind. "How dare you interfere with my case?" DeSalle said, "Look, I just have some questions. How about you re-interview Bill Bergen?" Hover said no. Quote, "Give me one shred of evidence that he did it," end quote. DeSalle said, "Well, she says he did." Hover barked, "How can you take a convicted murderer's word for it when this guy passed multiple lie detector tests?" Note that he actually forgot to mention Bill Bergen's tests were inconclusive, which the polygrapher attributed to his nervous condition. The governor was incensed that Hover wouldn't take the seemingly reasonable step of interviewing Bill Bergen one more time, but he also didn't totally trust his assessment of Edith's veracity either. He was worried about making a bad call. So he made one of the most controversial ones in Ohio political history. In early 1961, he decided to administer so-called truth serum to Edith Klump and ask her to once again describe the crime. A truth serum, aka sodium amytal, though it's now known as amobarbital, was essentially a sedative that some people believed all but eliminated a person's urge to lie. DeSalle believed in the stuff. So this sitting governor opted to personally interrogate a death row inmate under the influence of drugs. This was an unprecedented move. The Cincinnati Inquirer was among the skeptics. The paper ran a story headlined, "Truth Serum Widely Opposed," that told the story of an Englishman who confessed to murder under the influence of truth serum when he hadn't done it. The real murderer came forward days later to confess. Zonked on the serum as DeSalle asked her questions, Edith Klump didn't confess to anything new. She told DeSalle a story consistent with her second confession, that Bill Bergen had been the killer and she an accessory. That was enough for DeSalle. He announced that he was commuting her sentence to life in prison just hours before she was scheduled to face Ohio's Old Sparky, as the electric chair here was nicknamed. Hover was furious. Even though the physical evidence supported Edith's second confession, he was absolutely adamant that her first confession was the accurate one. It was, after all, the one prosecutors had presented in court. And if I've learned anything in my 30 years as a journalist, it's that prosecutors don't like admitting when they're wrong, ever. The public's reaction was mixed. They'd been reading about the seamstress slayer for more than a year. Now her life was spared by some controversial method. It seemed fishy to a lot of people. Many believed that DeSalle's decision to commute cost him re-election the following year. Edith Klump completed her sentence at Marysville and was paroled in 1971. She remarried, moved to Kentucky, and lived the rest of her life in obscurity. She died naturally on Christmas Eve in 1999 at 81 years old. Bill Bergen, meanwhile, had remarried before Edith's sentence was even commuted, this time to a much younger woman. He lived quietly and died in 2018 at the age of 90. His military tombstone at Danville National Cemetery in Virginia reads, "One Last Flight." Louise Bergen, of course, never got to see old age like her former husband and his lover did. She was just 32 when she was shot on Stratton Drive, then burned in a gravel pit at Cowan Lake in an attempt to hide the crime. Whether Bill Bergen pulled the trigger or whether Edith did, and whether it was an accident or murder, remains a question that can never fully be answered. What we do know is this. Ohio had been fascinated by the macabre tale of the seamstress slayer, but the case was about more than scintillating headlines. It was also about a prosecutor who refused to hear evidence that contradicted his case, a governor who risked everything to investigate that evidence, and a man who may have gotten away with killing his estranged wife by pinning the death on his trusting lover. To research this case, I read Richard O. Jones's book, Cincinnati Savage Seamstress, The Shocking Edith Klump Murder Scandal, which was published by the History Press in 2014. I also relied heavily on contemporary newspaper coverage from the Cincinnati Post, the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Virginian Pilot, the Ledger Star, and others. Additional background came from a 2012 blog post by University of Cincinnati archivist Janice Schultz, who spent years researching the case using the Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas prosecutor's records held at the UC Archives. I also watched the archival TV news footage of Edith's jailhouse interview, which you can find clips of online. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. This episode was produced by Amanda Rossman. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com on Instagram or at centuriespod.com. You can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.